Great. If all the panelists who are speaking today could come up, that would be great. I don't know about you, but anytime I come to a meeting or a forum, I have two things that I want to know. What is my expectation of coming into this meeting? Why am I here? Why did you come to this meeting? What are you expecting from this panelist, from this group of people? And the second thing that consciously or unconsciously that you also are asking yourself is that what is the expectation of when I leave this meeting? And those are fair questions. This is a magnificent building here. They don't build buildings like this anymore. And it's over 100, 200 years old. But more impressive here is the people that are in this room. You have probably over a millennium worth of professional criminal justice experience in this room. You have over 1,000 years worth of experience. You guys are old. So that also needs to be honored. This is not a one-way conversation. This is not just panelists presenting. This is a two-part forum. The first part of the forum, if you look into your agenda, will be these national speakers, statewide legislators, statewide experts that are going to be presenting from their perspectives of what they see of what works in reentry under a basis of collaboration, comprehensive, under an umbrella of evidence-based practices. Your homework is to ask questions and to say concerns. In your packet, there are some note cards. If you would use those note cards to write down your questions, your thoughts, your concerns, your fears, your frustrations about this topic and issue, so at the second half, when we have that discussion, we can answer those. If you could, Len will receive those note cards and then hand them to me, and so we can address that time. The reason why we're doing note cards is so that, again, it's a great place that has been known for great speeches, but we're not here for the speeches. We're here to hear your concerns, your thoughts, and ideas. The second part is that when you leave a meeting, it's sort of like, okay, been there, done that. The conversation needs to continue. And with that, there's also another piece of paper in there called discussion questions that has four questions in there. We want to know your thoughts and answers and suggestions of how to take it to the next step. With this meeting, we have two agenda items. The first is clarification of what's working in evidence-based practices with reentry, with offenders coming out of the criminal justice system. The second agenda item that we're looking for is an exploration, the exploration of how do we systematically establish this program within the state of Massachusetts. Those are the two aims. We need to respect everybody's different perspectives, whether it's a political perspective, a criminal justice perspective, the public perspective. In a previous life, I worked in housing. And in housing, you had three laws that you always stuck to. Everybody knows housing. Location, location, location. In the criminal justice system, there's the same three laws that still apply that we are, whether we consciously or unconsciously know about it. And that's safety, safety, and safety. That's safety for the officers and the staff that works within the criminal justice system. And basically, it means everybody gets to go home safe that night. Two, you have safety for the public, for our neighborhoods, for our families, for our community. And three, you have the safety for the offenders and the inmates and the people that are using the system and that are in the criminal justice system. And we have to keep that as the common denominator throughout this process, and it has to be in collaboration. The last part is that we're looking at this under evidence-based practices. And that sometimes is a hard part to grasp, because evidence-based practices is not a program. It's a set of policies and procedures that is based on scientific research that looks at reducing recidivism. And that's a hard thing to grasp. Probation and parole officer who'd been working in the system for 25 years finally said, "I got it." He says, "Evidence-based practices is not about being soft on crime. It's not about being hard on crime. It's about being smart on crime. And so much of the current criminal justice system looks at outputs instead of looking at outcomes. So we're taking a look at, yes, everybody has a caseload of 300-plus people for their probation officers. Yes, our jails are probably over 150% over capacity. Yes, we're prosecuting or defending X amount of cases per year. But the question coming back to is, what is the outcome of those cases? Are we reducing recidivism? Are we making the community safer? Are we changing offenders' thinking? Are there criminogenic thinking? Remember what evidence-based is not. Okay? It's not a program. It's also, this is not an issue of questioning your work. It's not questioning your professionalism, your dedication, the time and effort, and the years of experience of that. It is a paradigm change of looking at how we do work in a scientific research base. And the only way that you can implement evidence-based practices is in a collaborative method. And of course, it's a political term that everybody says, yes, we do things in collaboration. But if one agency within the criminal justice system does not participate under that auspices, you will sabotage the whole program. You have to have every part of the system, the police, the sheriffs, the jails, the magistrates, the prosecutors, the defense, probation, parole, the legislators. You need to have all elements working together at the table. And you know what? It's not easy. Okay? Now with that, let's get to the agenda. We started about 15 minutes late, and what I want to do is ask is that if everybody could stay 15 minutes late. My role as facilitator is two parts. One is to make sure that the panelists get heard, and that two, that you get heard. The second part of my role as facilitator is to be the taskmaster, the time master. So if we can look at the time when we start the panelist discussions, I'm going to be asking that we start in the clock really 15 minutes after the fact. So we, again, I want to make sure that we start on time and that too we finish on time. So at 12:15, 12:20, that's it. And it's Friday afternoon too. Okay. With that, the first part will be the panelists, the second part will be you. And we want to make sure that there's that dialogue and hearing your questions and concerns. Okay. So far, so good? Great. So, everybody has the packet, which has information about these speakers and an incredible wealth of experiences that they have. So the first part is the national experts. We have Mark Stringer, the director of the Division of Alcohol and Substance Abuse from Missouri in the Department of Mental Health, and we have Dale Parent from ABT Associates. So without further ado, thank you.
Good morning. Is this hear me okay? First of all, I would like to thank and congratulate Len and the Institute on this report. I've been really immersed in the literature about reentry since 2002, and I'll tell you that I haven't seen a more concise, well-written presentation of the issues. Along with some very strong recommendations. I just haven't seen a better document, so I really encourage you to spend some time with this. It's well worth it. Sometime in the late 1990s, I heard Peter Drucker at an international conference. Peter Drucker was an international guru on management and leadership. He wrote many books and was very well known. There was a four-day international conference on managing change, and so Peter Drucker was on the panel, like this, I guess, at the end of this four-day conference on managing change, and so they had experts from all over the world talk about how to manage change. And Peter Drucker, who then was in his late 70s probably, on this panel at the end, when the other panelists had spoken, said, his first words were, you know, there is no such thing as managing change. So in one sentence, he trumped the whole four-day conference, of course, because You know, there is no such thing as managing change. He said, you either lead change or you follow change. Those are your choices. Those words have really applied in this whole issue of reentry as many other areas. But, you know, in Missouri, we knew that things were changing with regard to our prison population because it was growing. And we were building jails and prisons, and nobody wanted to build more jails and prisons. So things were changing and will continue to change, and we just decided in this particular area we wanted to try to take control and lead the change. One of the things that is attractive about this, the whole issue of reentry, is that the target is really simple. You know, it's not nearly as complex as other government initiatives because the target is so simple. You know, we want to keep people who leave prison from committing more crimes and going back to prison. You know, everybody can understand that. Everybody can get on board with that because it makes economic sense. Prisons are very expensive. Jails are expensive. It makes sense from a human and political perspective because everybody wants safer communities too. And I think the lead sentence in this report is they all go home or they all come back, and that is true. About 97% of offenders will return home to their communities at some point. And so the issue is how do we want them to go back? There is always in a reentry effort like this. There is always a faction that will criticize you for this and say, "Well, you're soft on crime. You know, you're coddling these offenders and giving them, you know, all these services and things like that." You know, I was a probation and parole officer in Missouri back in the early 1980s, and I will tell you that this is the exact opposite of that. What is soft on crime are the kind of guys that I would get coming out of parole in our institutions, guys who had no education, no job skills. They had substance abuse problems or mental illness. They were completely unprepared. Was that hard on crime? No, because guys like that were coming back to prison so fast that, in fact, about one out of every three prison admissions in Missouri was a parole violator. That's not soft on crime. That's not hard on crime. That's soft on crime. What is hard on crime is when you give offenders the tools and the resources they need so that you can realistically hold them accountable for their success or failure. What is hard on crime is when you can hold multiples, not just the Department of Corrections or Probation and Parole, but when you can hold multiple state agencies accountable for providing the kind of assistance or the kind of training, education, case management, whatever offenders need to help them be successful and to keep communities safe. That's tough on crime, and that's what this is about. We started this effort in 2002 in Missouri, as I said, and I was involved from the very beginning. I usually come to conferences like this because I'm a sister agency that I'm with the Missouri Department of Mental Health, and people are always interested in how you get other state agencies to come to the table. So that's what I usually talk about, is how and why my department came to the table, came to work with the Department of Corrections and other departments, why we came together in 2002, why we have stayed together since 2002. Why it was that for a period of about 6 months, we had high-level officials from seven or eight state agencies and provider organizations that met every Friday morning for 3 hours, and this again was for 6 months, to pore over Missouri data about Missouri offenders, why they reoffend, why they come back to prison, so that we could identify Missouri-specific targets that we would approach as a group. And so I'll tell you just briefly that, you know, part of it was that in Missouri at the time when TPCI started, there was a charismatic, visionary director of the Department of Corrections in that case. Now, it doesn't have to be the corrections director. What this effort does require is someone who is a champion and a high-level champion. And the more complex your system is, the higher level that champion needs to be. But it's got to be someone who can pull people together and keep people together for some tough times, because this is tough. And there are some agencies that will come willing and others that you have to drag kicking and screaming to the table. But so we had a charismatic visionary leader. We had a team that was put together because of this leader, who was close to the governor and was able to get a lot of high-level support, including from other cabinet members. We were able to get the right people at the table for this. The other lesson that we learned was that for this to work, you can't have, like, junior leaders at the table. Everybody's got, large organizations have always got people that are like professional meeting attenders, you know who I'm talking about, that they don't do anything else very well, but you can sure send them off to all the meetings and stuff and let them be your meeting person. Well, you can't have those. And we had to, in fact, send some of those meeting people back to their agencies and have talks with their directors and say, this person can't make decisions. We've got to have decision makers at the table. So we had decision makers. We had a model. TPCI was the model that we chose that helped pull things together. It's very simple. Again, the target was simple. It created a common language. We were evidence-based before evidence-based was cool. We were dedicated to looking at Missouri-specific data and targeting our efforts to those variables that in Missouri caused high rates of recidivism. So having state-specific data is critical to getting your stakeholders on board. National statistics are interesting, but you know how people glaze over pretty quickly when you talk about that. If you get to state-specific, you get much better attention. So I think that's just a very brief kind of an overview. The lesson, again, I think the reason that my department as a sister agency got on board with this was that this was clearly something that required a collaborative effort. There was a strong change agent at the head of this. It was a simple model to understand. And again, it was something that was very much part of our mission as well as corrections, and that was to improve public safety. So thank you, Dale.
My name is Dale Parent, and I had the privilege from about 2000 to 2005 to serve as the director of the National Institute of Corrections Transition from Prison to Community Initiative. One of the first things that we did, thinking it would be a good thing to know where we're going with this project, was to figure out where we're going. So we assembled a national advisory panel, met with them for a period of about 15 months, supplemented that panel, and by the way, Harold Clark was a key member of that panel at that time, and so you've got a good in-house resource from based on his experience in that effort. Supplemented that with a series of working groups that had maybe another 25 individuals involved. These were folks who represented the field of corrections, the academic community that was interested in this set of issues. And so it was a very broadly based and representative group. And so the result, the product that we produced was not something that represented my thinking necessarily or the National Institute of Corrections thinking, but it really represented the thinking of the leadership of the field of American corrections. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so well received, is it's had a ring of reality to it and a strong ring of credibility to it almost from the outset. But let me just give you a couple of themes that this panel of national experts seized upon to guide our effort, and then describe briefly some of the key pieces of the model, which I think is something that really you should be looking at very carefully as a roadmap for what you need to do here. The first theme that emerged was that for the past 25 years, up until 1990, the field of corrections really had a threefold mission, by and large, most states. That was to provide a secure environment, keep the offenders in. Secondly, to provide a safe environment for offenders and staff. And third, to minimize operating costs. And that was about it. This sort of three-pronged mission inherently was inward-looking. The department sort of looked within itself, didn't get involved with outside agencies, didn't see itself as part of the broader social services system, and corrections historically is insulated and isolated, as evidenced by the walled prison concept, and this mission to sort of reinforce that. Our group thought that corrections needed to really fundamentally rethink its mission. It would have to obviously continue its focus on security in terms of keeping offenders where they're supposed to be behind bars. Secondly, continue its focus on providing a safe environment for staff and offenders. But thirdly, develop a outward-looking safety mission, which was to help reduce or improve public safety by reducing the recidivism rate of released offenders. And fourth, to make a change in mission to have a rational and effective use of available resources as opposed just to cost minimization. The second piece that they quickly seized upon was that to do this, we would need to have broad-scale collaboration across correctional and human services agencies, primarily because offenders have many problems, and those problems translate to risk factors in most cases. Substance abuse problem, the lack of employability, poor education, dysfunctional family life, et cetera, all increase the odds that an offender is going to reoffend upon release. And in our wisdom in terms of creating a criminal justice system and a human services system, we've created these agencies with hard boundaries between them that have jurisdiction over housing, jurisdiction over mental health, jurisdiction over juvenile affairs, et cetera. And these boundaries between the agencies really serve as a barrier to any kind of transmission of information across those boundaries and a barrier to any kind of collaboration or cooperation across agencies. So one of the key things that the model would require in order to address these risk factors that appear in the offender population is to get high level of collaboration across the agencies that have the authority to deal with those particular, the authority and the expertise and the resources to deal with that complex of problems. And it was our vision as a group that the reason those agencies would collaborate is that they would come to recognize that they had a common interest in better serving released offenders because that they could thereby improve the attainment of their core mission by doing so. And I'll give you an example of a sort of an aha moment that occurred in Michigan. By the way, Missouri was our first test state of this model, and Michigan was our second. We had some folks gathered around the table in Michigan, and one of the things they were doing, it was basically the high-level decision makers going through this six-month process of getting to know one another and getting to know their agencies. They were able to share information. DOC provided a list of all the people within their institutional custody. The department that had responsibility for housing ran a cross-check against their clientele list, and they found that they had a large overlap in the families of DOC offenders who were also being served by this agency. And further, they found that one particular unit within their department was spending almost $50 million a year to house in group home foster care facilities children of DOC inmates. And it was a rapidly growing budget item for the agency. They figured, as a result of that, they could probably cut that in half if they could unify the families and provide increased family support. So as a result of coming to that realization by sharing information, the housing agency decided to work with the department to fund a parenting program in the facilities that was also then carried over into the community, had a continuous focus, and the aim was to try to reduce these out-of-home placements by about 50%, thereby saving the housing agency big bucks over the course of a biennium. Those kinds of opportunities for collaboration exist in scores of areas of intersection between criminal justice and, or between corrections and human services agencies, but you won't find out about them until you get to the table, collaborate, share information, and work out those kinds of possibilities. But this idea of a common interest among these agencies in serving offenders that helps each agency achieve its respective mission is really the glue that will hold those collaborative relationships together. The second piece of the NIC model that was important has already been talked about here, one that it's evidence-based, that the processes and that the model sets forth are based upon good, solid evidence that if you do this, you're going to improve the outcomes. The second thing about the model that NIC developed was, as I call it, was an aspirational model. That is, it challenged correctional and human services agencies to aim high. It didn't set minimal standards. It set a very hard-to-reach high target and argued that the agencies needed to really use that as a guide star. Maybe they wouldn't ever attain it, but they would always be striving toward it. Finally, let me indicate that there are several key elements to the model. The first is that reentry activities start the day an offender enters prison. They're not something you do the last 30 or 60 or 90 days that a person is confined. As soon as people come into prison, there's use of an actuarial risk assessment instrument that will identify what we call dynamic risk factors, ones that can be altered by some interventions and thereby permit the lessening of risk. The development of a reentry plan for offenders that addresses a critical mass of these dynamic risk factors provides an adequate dosage of intervention to realistically have an effect, that has continuity between an in-prison and a post-prison phase of the reentry plan, and that uses case management approaches to make sure that elements of the individual plan are actually delivered. The other piece that is important is that the model suggests that agencies target their limited reentry resources on higher risk offenders. So you don't just throw your money at the low risk people, by and large, who are going to not profit as much from the intervention, but you focus them on the higher risk offenders. Obviously, this creates a need to have a cultural change within a correctional agency when you move from a inward-looking confinement, cost-cutting mindset to one which has this outward-looking public safety perspective. That means you're going to have to change the way you do business so that you give operational effect to that change in mission. You're going to have to probably alter the skills of your staff, either by changing the staff or by training the staff or by doing other things, and you're going to probably have to reallocate resources within your agency, all of which is gut-wrenching for agencies, but it needs to be done. Likewise, if you get a multi-agency collaboration going on around reentry, it also means that the other agencies likewise are going to have to do some internal alteration to give sort of a cultural change emphasis. So it's tough work. It's hard work. I'm done. But it can be done.
You have two more minutes, but sorry. So just some themes that we're hearing just from Mark and Dale is